We are in Kamchatka, land of fire-breathing volcanoes. Volcanoes vividly capture the imagination, and they define our lives much more than you would expect. So what are they capable of, and what makes Kamchatka's volcanoes stand out? It's unlikely anyone knows more about volcanoes here than Alexei Ozorov. He's the chief volcanologist in Kamchatka. Alexei, thanks for coming up here with us. This is a fascinating view, that is for sure. So here in Kamchatka, there are about 300 volcanoes, they say. 30 of them are believed to be active. Why such a concentration of volcanoes here in Kamchatka?
Kamchatka is one of the most active places in the world. There are 7,000 big, small, and medium-sized volcanoes here. As you rightly observed, 300 of them are big cones, and 30 are active volcanoes that are erupting now, could erupt, or have erupted long ago. Kamchatka also has four super-active volcanoes that are guaranteed to erupt every year. I call them super-volcanoes. They are Shivyeluch, Kluchevskoy volcano, Bezmiani over there, and Karimsky. And so Kamchatka is a cross-section of powerful volcanic activity. That's because 150 kilometers east of here, in the ocean, the Pacific tectonic plate is sinking under the Eurasian tectonic plate. That plate is about 100 meters thick. It goes down a few hundred kilometers, and down there, it releases hot liquid because of the water all around it. That hot fluid melts the rocks, turning them into magma, and the magma reaches the surface in Kamchatka. The Pacific plate under Kamchatka is sinking 10 centimeters every year. That's very fast. The greater the speed, the more magma is produced and ultimately released, and so we have more volcanoes that erupt more frequently.
So, you mentioned that we're right here on the ocean, specifically the Pacific Ocean. The Kamchatka Peninsula juts out into it. What is the Pacific Ring of Fire, and what role does Kamchatka play in that ring?
That's a very good question. It's a very important question. The Pacific Ring of Fire to humanity is the most expansive geological structure that exists on the planet. It's 80,000 kilometers. It's huge. It accounts for 80% of the active volcanoes on Earth, 80% of earthquakes on Earth, and 89% of tsunamis. It also impacts 35% of the people on our planet, more than a third. So even from these broad calculations, you can see that this is a very important structure for humanity. So yes, it is a ring of fire. And Kamchatka is one of the most active segments within that ring.
What about looking inside volcanoes? Is it safe to say that looking into a volcano is like looking inside our Earth? And what's the most important thing that a volcano can tell us when we take that look?
A volcano is like a window into the depths of our planet. You can have a look, and it's a whole complex of things that we can understand and see what's going on inside the Earth. First of all, the melted rock we're now standing on. This solidified magma comes from literally thousands of kilometers under the surface. That's where it's produced. So the first thing we can do is study this material, where it came from, how it got here, how it evolved, and what's inside it. That's one of the most important things for us. The next thing we can do is understand the root system of volcanoes that heat the overlying rock. The overlying rock is located in the water here, so geothermal stream fields can form. These geothermal stream fields are a source of green energy, which is becoming more popular with every year, and of course, more necessary. In fact, we really should worry about the state of our planet. Another very important factor that's also related to volcanoes is gas. Gas is released by volcanoes into the atmosphere and help create the conditions that allow us to breathe and live. One of the most distinguished scientists of his time, who worked at the Institute of Volcanology and Seismology in Kamchatka, was Dr. Yevgeny Markinin, who authored the theory that life on Earth evolved thanks to volcanic activity. Well, they helped form the general conditions on Earth Earth, that's clear. He believed that volcanoes made it possible for life to evolve on Earth. It required some very specific conditions, the combination of the right temperature, gases, water, electric discharges, and so on. At some point, something close to life began to evolve, and later, that process continued on its own.
Now, I've heard you mention a couple times during our conversation that there are different types of volcanoes. And I've also heard you say that volcanoes are like people. They're all different. Can you tell the different volcanoes around here from their personalities?
Yes, of course.
Скажи.
Вулканы.
Volcanoes even sleep in different ways. And the way they erupt is also completely different. On the whole, we can divide volcanoes into a few types. There are basalt volcanoes. That's the deepest material. When it comes up to the surface, it practically doesn't change at all. It flows in beautiful lava streams. This is always visible and one that media always shows us, because everyone loves watching them. There are others. If the magma is held underground, its composition changes, crystals form, and it turns into andesitic magma. Andesitic magma practically doesn't flow at all. It just explodes. It's very dangerous and unpredictable. And andesitic magma, well, one of the most famous andesitic magma volcanoes is Mount St. Helens. In Russia, it's Bezmiani, Shivyeluch, and Ksudach. So these volcanoes have a different composition, and when they erupt, photographers have little chance of capturing them, as they explode in seconds and destroy everything. That's why we rarely see them. Then the other types are dacite and rhyolite volcanoes, that often form big calderas, and so on. So, depending on the condition of the material, and depending on whether it's basalt, dacite, or rhyolite, and based on the magmatic system involved, volcanic eruptions can be completely different. Then take into account a volcano's age, height, the amount of time since its last eruption, and you can see there are huge differences.
Right, I have to ask, which is your favorite volcano and why?
The first time I visited a volcano, I was a student, Ilyinsky, a fantastic, beautiful volcano. Then I worked on the Gorelli volcano after it erupted. Then when I got a job at the Institute of Volcanology, I began working at the fantastic Ključevskoy volcano, which erupts quite often. In America, on the Kilauea volcano in Hawaii, I collected lava samples that were like bombs. Everyone wondered how it was possible. Then I was in Antarctica, then Japan, then here working on Shivyeluch, then Bezmiani. A huge number of volcanoes. They're all different, and I like each one of them. I constantly return to Ključevskoy, of course. I've written a book about it, and so, to answer your question seriously, I can say that my love for volcanoes is multifaceted. I love all volcanoes, but Ključevskoy is always special to me.
Perfect. All right, I know that we're in the middle of a bunch of volcanoes right now, but there's other places that we need to get to. Let's get to them.
Of course!
Volcanoes erupt in Kamchatka almost every day. The Shevelich and Bezmiani volcanoes had explosive eruptions just recently, and engineer and volcanologist Victor Frolov was caught right in the thick of it.
Victor, thanks for bringing us out here to Shevelich, your area of special expertise. When most of us think of a volcanic eruption, we think of lava. But what's really happening behind the scenes? When a volcano erupts, what's the process like? What is actually happening?
If I may refer to Shevelich, the volcano that you can see right here is an example. In movies, you'd expect to see this big, tall mountain with red hot lava flowing down the sides. But that's what you'll never see with Shevelich. You might see some red hot rocks rolling down at night, glowing in the dark, but that's it. What you might see from an eruption is a cloud of volcanic gas and ash shooting up 20 kilometers and then falling over a large area. During the most recent eruption on April 11th this year, my team and I witnessed the ash spreading over an area about 200 by 400 kilometers. That's an insanely huge area that covers a large part of central and northern Kamchatka.
You were here, you saw it with your own eyes. I would even have to go as far as to say you experienced it. What was that like?
In a nutshell, it all started at 7 a.m. In fact, the eruption started at 1 a.m., but no one noticed while asleep, and it was dark, hard to see anything. At 7 a.m., we got a call from our driver who said, there's some sort of loud thunder out there. We walked out and saw snow falling, so we thought it was a storm. It was still dark. We used our flashlight and saw these beautiful large flakes falling down, but when we tried to catch them, we noticed it was gray ash. It was pitch dark, no light at all, and remained dark, and the ash kept falling for 4 hours. The first sunlight broke through the cloud around midday. Until then, it was so dark, as if someone switched off the sun and stars. You couldn't see your own hand without a flashlight. In our settlement that's located 45 kilometers south of the volcano, we had a layer of ash 8.5 centimeters thick. On the volcano slopes, the layer of ash was between 12 and 14 centimeters thick, about this much. And all this happened within a very short time, less than 24 hours. Lots of ash and lots of thunder. As the ash cloud erupts, it can also trigger lightning. 50 kilometers away, it sounded like a cargo train was running through the village. It was incredibly loud. Volcano eruptions often disrupt both local and international air traffic. Klyuchevskoye can eject ash clouds up to 20 kilometers high. Shevelutch here too is capable of the same. In April this year, Bezimyani spewed up ash plume over 10 kilometers high. This is dangerous because volcanic ash is made of tiny particles of glass. While sea glass has smooth edges from being rolled in water for a long time, volcanic ash has very sharp edges. It can really hurt if you inhale it or hurt your eyes. They are harmful to all kinds of aircraft because they disrupt the engines. Back in April, we had a few snowmobiles we were using, and three of them broke down after just 2 days. Overall, volcanic ash can do a lot of harm. It's a pretty aggressive substance. First of all, in terms of people's health, but also in terms of machinery. The ash is also heavy, and large amounts of it can damage roofs. The plus, after the eruption, the ash helps new vegetation grow. Now, plants grow very well, even bigger and stronger than before the eruption. So in a way, the ash is a fertilizer for local soil. If you observe a volcano for many years in a row, you will see that first, an eruption destroys everything that grew on it. But 5 to 10 years later, there will be a much thicker and bigger forest growing there again. So, volcanoes both destroy and support life.
Alexei, we're a little bit crazy. We're standing on an actual lava flow. Coming in was absolutely fascinating because you could see some thermal vents still letting off their steam. I guess I have to ask, we hear about volcanoes being dormant, this one or that one. What does it take for a volcano actually to erupt and to become active again?
Volcanoes don't go anywhere. They can always wake up because there's always a thermal flow beneath them that generates new magma. As soon as a certain quantity of magma builds up, there's practically no other way for it to go. It reaches the surface and a fantastic eruption takes place. It's only a matter of time. If the quantity of magma generated is not sufficient, then the sleep intervals are long. If a lot of magma builds up quickly, the intervals are short.
Now, I've heard that one in every 10 volcanoes that erupt happen right here in Kamchatka. Is that true?
More or less.
We know that some volcanic eruptions can be predicted, but some not. We know that there's also that there's a lot of interesting research in this field and new information that is coming forth. What makes the difference in terms of when we know and when we don't know?
That's one of the most important questions in volcanology. We've noted that all volcanoes are different. If a volcano hasn't erupted for a long time and all of a sudden magma begins to rise closer to the surface, breaking its way through the rock, then we get a volcanic earthquake. But if there's a route out for the magma already well established, like with the Ключевской volcano, the magma quite calmly flows to the surface. Earthquakes that precede an eruption are rarely felt, so it heavily depends on the type of volcano, on its structure, and how long it's been since an eruption in the area.
This is more of a question for my mom. Are we safe? Is it possible for a volcano to erupt right now before our eyes?
Especially for your mum. When you're on a volcano with an expert volcanologist, you'll be fine. But without one, there's no guarantee.
In terms of the age of volcanoes, how old is the volcano that we're standing on right now?
The lava that you're now standing on dates back to 2012-2013. It's young lava. These are all young volcanoes. We always put a particular focus on studying young volcanoes. That's my job. I love studying young volcanoes because this place is a work in progress. It's very important to have access to the process as it occurs. Geology and earth science study three states of matter.
Gas,
liquid, and solid. But volcanology is distinguishable from all the rest, as it also studies liquid matter. Liquid, here, say, 10 years ago.
That brings me to another question about the force of a volcano. Is it possible to predict how strong an eruption is going to be? For example, there's this myth or an idea that if it's been dormant for a long time and then it goes to erupt, that it's going to be a more powerful eruption?
On the whole, it can be possible, but not always. There's a method called tephrochronology, which is very important for understanding how powerful an eruption of a volcano will be. So you take a layer of ash deposit, study the lava, study other processes, study the volcano's depth structure, and then we reconstruct the history of the volcano that already exists. And accordingly, we can make predictions about future processes that may take place. And so studying the geology, the tephrochronology, the lava, petrology, and geophysics, a lot of complex research, that might show us how a volcano will function.
Alexei, I'm going to ask you to look into the future, to be a clairvoyant, if you don't mind. When do you think the next big eruption is going to happen here in Kamchatka?
I hope I'll be young and strong enough to witness that eruption. And that my institute is still going to be strong for us to do a good job studying it. And that we'll be able to predict whether this eruption will be dangerous for people here in Kamchatka, as well as for planes and everything else. So I hope it will happen in the near future, 10, 20, 30 years. That's not a long time in geology.
One more step, and just your intuition here. What about the next big eruption in the world?
Well, it will definitely happen. And we already have a huge number of problems in the world, a huge number of volcanoes. In Kamchatka, in Iceland, in the Philippines, there are also underwater volcanoes. I wouldn't try to guess now. It would be better to do this. I'd end all these conflicts between countries, unite the countries around the Pacific Ring of Fire, and have all their scientists work together using different methods to predict the very extreme and ominous events that definitely await us. That would be great.
Alexei, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for bringing us out here. Now we got to get out of here safely, huh?
You know how it works. Whenever you're with me, you'll be fine.
It is impossible not to mention our pilots here. This is one of the most difficult places on Earth to navigate, and is considered that some of the most experienced pilots are here in Kamchatka. Yevgeny Karateyev was ours.
We can't do the story without talking to the pilots, because we've seen some amazing flying with you guys here. So thank you for that. I guess I have to ask, what is it like flying in these conditions around volcanoes? Is it exciting? Is it scary? Is it just normal?
It's a lot of fun flying around Kamchatka. At first, when I just started working here, it was a little intimidating. But eventually, it grew on me. In fact, after Kamchatka, any other place, especially with no mountains to fly around, feels dull. Kamchatka has become a second home to me.
I know that heat can actually change the aerodynamics of an aircraft, and in this region, there's lots of thermal zones where there's volcanic activity. How does that affect your flying? Is it dangerous?
In 2013,
when Tolbatchik erupted over there, we flew above the lava river, and the pilot had a hard time with the helicopter. We kept losing altitude because of the heat, so it was really dangerous. There was also a situation in Gorili volcano. We went there with a team of volcanologists. The crater of the volcano is quite small, so the guys went down. They had a rescuer with them, whose job is to make sure they can make it back up using ropes. But something went wrong and they got stuck. It was really dark and we had to think of a way to get them out. So we flew the chopper down slowly into the crater and picked them up. It was something else. Quite a story.
Thank you very much. It's been incredibly interesting flying with you, and we appreciate the work that you do. Appreciate it.
Спасибо.
It's not just the volcanoes that give Kamchatka this unworldly landscape. Calderas and geysers are some of nature's unique creations. Here in Kamchatka, there's a whole valley of them. This is where we will speak to Yulia Frolova, a geologist and expert in these phenomena.
Yulia, this is kind of a landscape from a different world. Thank you for bringing us out here. Before we get to this, I want to ask you about calderas. We know that they're related to volcanic activity, but what exactly are they?
A caldera is a very large structure measuring many kilometers in diameter. It emerges as a result of a massive eruption when a large amount of magma bursts out of a pool located close to the surface, causing a big explosion. After that, as the magma pool empties, the land caves in, forming a large recess, like a vast depression or a bowl, confined by faults. An example of that is the Uzun Geyser Caldera, where we are standing now. If you look over there, you will see the edge of an ancient caldera that was formed tens of thousands of years ago.
Wow. Now, when we were flying over here, we saw this beautiful lake, Mali Semyachik. It was beautiful in terms of its color. It's been called Green Lake, but now it's blue, but it's not really water down there, is it? It's something else, perhaps. We wouldn't want to go swimming there, would we?
The Mali Semyachik volcano and the lake at the bottom of its crater are two absolutely unique phenomena. They are unique because the water in the lake is extremely acidic, with a pH level below 1. Essentially, it's a solution of sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid, and even a little hydrofluoric acid, a very strong mix. The volcanologist that went to explore the lake in a rubber boat barely made it back to the shore, as the aluminum oars that they were using to row had nearly dissolved. So the lake is absolutely unique to here. Similar ones can be found in Japan, Indonesia, and New Zealand, but they are extremely rare in the world. In Kamchatka, this is the only lake like that. The volcano Gareli used to have a lake like this before, but that one disappeared after an eruption in 2010. So we are left with just this one. In fact, the volcano is getting more active now. The water level in the lake is rising, and something dangerous may happen soon. The crater wall may collapse, letting all of this strong, aggressive, acidic water flood the surrounding area. It's a good thing nobody lives around here.
Let's talk about geysers. We know that they're very rare, and we know that they are connected to volcanic activity. What are they?
Geysers are a very rare phenomenon. There are hundreds and thousands of thermal springs in the world and very few geysers. Almost every one of them has a name and its own temper. How does it work? This area of the Valley of Geysers is the edge of a large caldera, the Uzun Geyser caldera, which acts as a giant water reservoir. Subsurface rocks have cracks in them, and water filters down through those cracks to the body of magma close to the surface. There, the water is heated up to 300 degrees, gets saturated with gases, and then this hydrothermal flow starts rising towards the surface.
What about the difference between hot springs and geysers? I know that you wouldn't want to go swimming in one of these. Briefly tell me the difference between those.
A spring is boiling and bubbling all the time. Sometimes they call it a pulsating spring. Essentially, it's always active, whereas a geyser shoots water periodically, and it can go silent for hours, sometimes days, depending on the geyser. So that's the key difference. The two have distinct hydrodynamic behaviors. The water itself is just wonderful. And if I could, I'd go swimming in a geyser after this trip. I would. It's sodium chloride water with a low mineralization, a neutral to subalkaline composition, and contains some nice elements like salicylic acid and boron. All of that is really good for your health. I'd go take a bath like that any time of the day. But there is just one small problem. Geothermal springs can be cold, warm, hot, and boiling. And a geyser is a type of a boiling spring, which says it all. Humans are imperfect creatures. We cannot bathe in water that's heated up to 90 to 100 degrees Celsius. That said, there are some hardcore organisms in nature that can actually enjoy geysers. You may have noticed the colorful rock formations around the geyser blowholes. These are thermophilic microorganisms that settle. They like both the near-boiling water and the extreme pH conditions. They also like mercury, antimony, and other elements. Those are the kinds of amazing creatures we've got here. And one more thing, these thermophiles are the reason that geyserite is painted in such vibrant and saturated colors. By itself, the geyserite is gray and unimpressive. But thanks to thermophilic organisms, we have all this stained glass-like artwork to enjoy.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. It's been incredibly interesting, and I can't wait to learn more.